Welcome everybody to our June Pulmonary Pathology Journal Club. We have four articles to discuss, as well as a number of other articles for notation, etc. I'm going to start off giving the floor to Rachel Fels-Elliott, our thoracic pathology fellow here at the University of Michigan, and she'll start off discussing the first.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I just shared my screen. Are you able to see that?
Yes, we see it. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. So I'm going to be presenting this paper titled Thoracic Nut Carcinoma, Expanded Pathological Spectrum with Expression of TTF1 and Neuroendocrine Markers, published in Histopathology. So for background, we know that nut carcinoma is an aggressive malignancy driven by rearrangements in the NUT-M1 gene. And classically, the histologic appearance shows squamous differentiation with areas of abrupt keratinization. However, this study was actually inspired by an index case that showed diffuse expression of TTF1. And for that reason, it was initially diagnosed as pulmonary adenocarcinoma. The purpose of this study was twofold. First, they wanted to explore how often nut carcinomas are not recognized institutionally, initially in their institution rather, and they wanted to describe the spectrum of morphology and the immunophenotype in these rare tumors. So they had a threefold approach to their methods. First, they performed a retrospective review of surgical pathology files at Massachusetts General Hospital. And second, they searched for NUT-M1 rearrangements in over 2,000 consecutive primary thoracic tumors. And these were analyzed in a database of RNA-based fusion sequencing assays. And finally, they performed NUT immunohistochemistry on tissue microarrays that contained an additional 425 primary lung adenocarcinomas. So moving on to results, they identified 6 patients with thoracic nut carcinomas. These were all confirmed by molecular, and they included 5 men, 1 woman, 4 were never smokers. There was a wide age range. The median age was 58. Which is a little bit older than we usually think of for nut carcinomas. And the median time to death was 2.8 months. Most of their patients had bulky central disease, except for their index case, which predominantly had pleural disease. And only 2 of the cases were identified initially on histopathology. And the other 4 were identified much later by molecular testing. And this included the index case. So for those 4 cases, the initial diagnoses included metastatic adenocarcinoma of the lung, in the case of the index case, squamous cell carcinoma with basaloid features, poorly differentiated carcinoma, and non-small cell carcinoma. In their sequencing database, NUT-M1 rearrangements accounted for only 0.23% of all primary thoracic malignancies that were tested. And they didn't find any additional cases by performing IHC screening on their TMAs of 425 adenocarcinomas. Histologically, all of the tumors had a primitive appearance. And you can see here an example of the H&E from the index case. And there were focal areas of keratinization in 4 of 6 cases. This is TTF1 expression in figure D for the index case, which was only found in 1 of the 6 cases. 3 of 4 cases showed focal expression of P40. 3 of 4 had expression of CK56. 5 of 5 that were tested showed nuclear staining for NUT protein. 2 of 6 expressed synaptophysin. 1 of 6 expressed chromogranin. And 2 of 2 tested had some expression of INSM1. So the first take-home message from this paper is that diagnosis of NUT carcinoma clearly remains challenging. Two-thirds of their cases were diagnosed weeks to months later by molecular. And the key finding in this paper is that NUT carcinoma can occasionally express TTF1 and or neuroendocrine markers. So this is a diagnostic pitfall to be aware of. And so based on this, the authors conclude that NUT immunohistochemistry and or molecular testing should be considered in basically all primitive appearing tumors in the thoracic cavity, regardless of the immunophenotype. And there is some emerging clinical relevance to this because selective bromodomain inhibitors are under clinical investigation, which target the fusion partner of the NUT M1 gene. So that's all I have. I'd be happy to field any questions or comments about the paper.
I have a question. So they seem to be starting with molecular testing for over 2,000 cases. So that's kind of a very daunting job, I suppose. So did they do the immunohistochemistry at the same time? Or so did they do IHC on all cases or not?
That's a great question. So what they did in terms of their database is they have a running database for this RNA-based fusion assays that they're performing predominantly on all of their adenocarcinomas, but they did have some squamous cell carcinomas and poorly differentiated malignancies and they included everything, lung, mediastinum, I think chest wall was in there, but they excluded esophagus and heart. So that was separate than the cases that they interrogated in their surgical pathology files at MGH. And so those were all cases signed out in the thoracic cavity, and they may or may not have had molecular. It sort of depended whether or not that case was sent for molecular, if that makes sense. And so that was how they were determining whether it was diagnosed upfront or not. And then the third prong was that they had TMAs that were pre-existing, which contained the 425 lung adenocarcinomas. And so they performed NUT IHC on those TMAs. And they did not identify any cases just by that screening of their TMAs of adenos. Yeah, sorry, I was just going to say for their six cases that they identified, as I was going through the immunos, they had performed, I guess, all of them TTF1, but then the other markers to varying degrees. One didn't have NUT performed, and that's because I think it was they used FISH, and it was before they'd introduced the NUT immunohistochemistry. So that's kind of how this study, it was a bit patchy in terms of their IHC.
So the burning question is, you know, we don't do the not, you know, the molecular study right off the bat. So we always kind of worry about sensitivity of the NUT IHC. So it sounds like they don't have any more, you know, false negative, I guess.
I don't think so, because all of their, that's a good point, because all of their cases that they tested, 5 out of 5, were positive for NUT. So that seems like they don't have any false negatives.
So in other words, you know, not negative cases turned out to be the molecular positive. I mean, that's all we have, you know, have to deal with.
I think their methods would not have identified that because they're not screening. They're maybe not screening the right group. They're screening the 425 adenocarcinomas. So that's a big number, but they didn't screen, for example, 425 poorly differentiated squames, which might have been a more interesting group to look at. So the way that they selected their cases, they already knew they had the molecular alteration and then they performed the IHC. So we don't know in a big group of, you know, poorly differentiated squames, for example, whether some of the, do you know what I mean? Because not all of their squamous cell carcinomas would have gone for molecular in their database. Yes, that molecular database is enriched probably for adenos.
In the limited cases that they did a molecular and the IHC, at least they can see if there was any false negative by immunohistochemistry, because I mean, that's what we worry about, you know. But anyway,
retrospectively, they didn't find that.
They didn't find that. Okay.
Well, yeah, that's in table two.
Okay. I'll go back and find. Yep. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So we don't have NUT here, and we send our tumors away if we suspect it, but I'm sure we're missing a lot of them. Should we be doing NUT on every poorly differentiated carcinoma of the lung or mediastinum?
This paper is suggesting to perform it on every primitive appearing tumor. That's my, I guess, takeaway from this paper. And I think that's a reasonable idea, although you can tell from that 0.23% of their database of 2,000 tumors that it's rare. So the yield is going to be low, but they are suggesting that it's useful. And I guess particularly because these bromodomain inhibitors are coming down the pipeline, it might be important to consider that.
Well, we do have the NUT stain, and I think, I mean, Jen and Jen, please chime in. We perform it quite often, and it's really rare. It really only rarely turns out to be.
Yeah.
But a good hint is if a tumor is positive for both P40 and TTF1, we have seen that too. And the same cells basically express P40 and TTF1. You know, I was quite interested in, because we are talking about these bromodomain inhibitors since probably at least 2 years. Is there any evidence that they actually work?
The papers that I've been reading are just trying them as very, you know, third, fourth line in patients who have very advanced disease. And so it seems like small groups of patients still. I don't know if anyone else has more information than that. So it is working in some patients, but not a lot, not a large number. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, are there any clinical features that could help you decide on whether you should look for NUT?
Yeah. So classically, they're young patients with bulky central disease and presenting at a high stage. What this paper tried to point out is that they actually had a pretty wide age range of patients, I think from 31 to 80, and their median age was 58, which is older than we sort of classically think of.
Yeah.
And they had that one index case, which is a weird case with the diffusely positive TTF1, and it was mostly like caking of the pleura. And so that was a very strange pattern of disease, but they were saying, you know, think beyond this typical young patient with bulky central disease.
It would make a difference in treatment, because if they're synaptophysin positive, they might get labeled as carcinoid and have different treatment to your regular adenocarcinomas.
For those of you who have seen NUT, proven NUT carcinomas, I just drilling down to when you use the NUT IHC, which we literally just brought on board last week. Do you feel like the cases that have turned out to be bona fide are, they look like solid non-small cell carcinomas mostly, or are you capturing ones where it's that kind of tumor that you're not sure between even a small cell or a sarcoma and non-small cell? I'm just trying to get a sense of what morphologically people have seen.
Well, to me, usually they look quite monotonous, and they have prominent nucleoli, and sometimes you see quite a few neutrophils in them. But I have seen cases signed out as small cell carcinoma too, because they had crush artifact and so on. So it probably depends also on the specimen you get. And one case was really nice. There you saw an abrupt onset with squamous differentiation, but that was a quite large biopsy. So usually we don't probably see that.
Yeah, we had a case here that it wasn't clear it was a carcinoma, and I shared it with Dave Lucas thinking maybe it was a small round cell sarcoma, and he actually did the NUT stain and it was beautifully positive. And I have to say it hadn't entered my mind. So I think we need to do it more often, not less often, recognizing that it's a rare event. But I mean, we routinely do molecular studies for what are rare, equally rare events.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Rachel. I just want to take the opportunity to thank Rachel. She's ending her fellowship here. She's been an absolutely terrific fellow. We will miss her very much. She's going off to a wonderful group at the University of Kansas, and they are lucky to get her. So thanks, Rachel.
Good luck.
Thank you.
We'll start the second. Hopefully I can share my screen here. Can you see my screen for the second paper?
Yes.
An interesting area, just I thought it was worth this group talking about. This paper is sialadenocarcinoma or adenoma proliferum of the bronchus, or SP. It's an unrecognized bronchial counterpart of salivary gland tumors that frequently has the BRAF mutations. And this was done by a large group of Japanese pathologists and pathologists at the Mass General. The slides here. There we go. So in general, primary tracheobronchial tumors of the lung are uncommon, and the vast majority of them are malignant. The salivary gland type tumors that arise within the bronchial glands are most commonly adenoid cystic and MEC. More rare malignant and benign variants, including EMCs, as well as pleomorphic adenomas and SPs, have been reported. But given the crucial difference in how they're managed, large resections, segmental resections of big airways, I thought it was interesting to present this case that I think brings some clarity, not a lot, but some clarity regarding the difficult pathologic differential diagnosis that is essential in that area of the lung. So SPs are rare and benign and thought to arise in what's called the excretory duct of these submucosal salivary gland-like glands in the lung. The tumor has histologic features of both a surface exophytic papillary proliferation and then this deep multicystic intraductal papillary epithelial component, which can be mistaken for malignancy. Three previous cases had been reported as per this group, but they found it difficult to confirm that diagnosis given the superficial nature of the biopsy. In addition, the idea of BRAF mutations in these lesions was wanted to be looked at. So the purpose of this study, it reports clinical, pathologic, immunohistochemical, and molecular features of four cases of SP that arise in the bronchus. They discuss the diagnostic pitfalls of glandular papilloma, mixed squamous glandular papilloma, and then bronchial adenomas, and then report the results of BRAF mutations as evaluated in their four cases. So the way they found these cases was heroic. They had from five different large hospitals in Japan, they had five head and neck pathologists scour the archives, and they came up with four cases of what all agreed were histologically SPs from the lung. They then did H&Es, PAS, Music Carmen, IHC for BRAF, and then TTF1 as well. They also did the mutational analysis both by PCR and Sanger sequencing, and those are the results that they report. So what did they find? They found it within this age range of 52 to 72, half male, half female. They arose in the secondary and quaternary branches of the bronchi, three on the right, one on the left. So it's very central lesions. The size was small, less than 2 centimeters, somewhere between 6 and 16 millimeters. Interestingly, the pre-op biopsy diagnosis in three of the four lesions suspected atypical or malignant tumors. Two cases were treated with bronchoscopic resection. One case was treated with lobectomy, and one case was treated with a sleeve resection. One of the four tumors was subsequently, that was called an adenocarcinoma. The biopsy was diagnosed as carcinoma of the salivary gland on the resection. The other three were actually diagnosed as SP on the resection. This is that table one from the paper, and you can see the pre-op diagnosis. SP was made 1 out of 4 times, and the other three diagnoses were atypical columnar papilloma, adenocarcinoma, and then atypical squamous proliferation. And then even on the resection specimen, one was called a malignancy. Again, two bronchoscopic resections, a lobectomy, and a sleeve lobectomy was performed. they performed P63 and TTF1 and found that the P63 was positive in the basal cells in the exophytic papillary epithelium, as well as that submucosal multicystic component. SMA was negative. TTF1 was negative throughout all the columnar epithelial cells as well as the basal cells. And they found two of the four positive for BRAF mutations by BRAF IHC. I just wanted to show you, these are a little bit fuzzy images, but show you the pictures from the paper in case you didn't get a time to look at it. So on the left here, this is that exophytic papillary frongs, and these are the submucosal multicystic kind of dilated gland-like structures. You can see the complex architecture of that exophytic papillary proliferation, and it is scary looking, as in all honesty, is the submucosal kind of multicystic glands that one sees on the other part of the tumor, has this kind of fibrinous exudate classic 4SPs. This is another case. Again, this is the exophytic component, shows again this complex architecture of the epithelium, a little bit more of a almost cribriforme, but glandular complexity of that component. And then finally, this is a low power, shows you that it comes out of these very proximal airways, out of the the excretory canals there, and then grows on the surface of the airway. It shows a rather exuberant squamoid, squamous type of proliferation. And they talk in the paper, which seemed a little bit confusing, of this abrupt transition of ciliated and non-ciliated that makes it more likely to be part of that excretory duct. This is the immunohistochemistry that was performed, shows the positive P63, the SMA as stated was negative. You can see it nicely outlined at confirming this intraductal location. And of note, the columnar and the cuboidal cells were all negative for TTF1. So their main differential was a glandular papilloma or a mixed glandular squamous. These are the things to keep in mind, but again, there's a little bit of ambiguity around all of these in my mind. SP is more central, GM and MPs, or GPs and MPs should be more peripheral. GP and MPs have more ciliated mucous cells because they originate out from the bronchial epithelium. Bronchial adenoma is this growing spectrum that includes CMPTs now, based on a previous publication from MJ SurgePath in 2018. They're more mucinous, they're not as papillary, but they do have rare TTF1 positive cells, whereas the CPs have a non-ciliated columnar cell. They have this mix of ciliated mucous squamous cells that present focally, and they can have some cytologic atypia. So overall, I think what this paper does is it makes us recognize a CP as something that can occur in the lung. If you're a head and neck pathologist, you may have seen it more often. It shows us the complex architecture of the epithelial tufts that can mimic the micropapillary adenocarcinoma. In fact, one was diagnosed as an adenocarcinoma. It shows us that there are nuclear features that are mild to moderate in atypia, rare mitoses that can raise the possibility, as it did in one of these cases, of an in situ. The P63 will confirm the intraductal basal cell rimming. 50% of these cases will have BRAF mutations. And then this differential diagnosis of glandular, mixed glandular squamous, and then bronchial adenomas. I think the interesting part of this paper is that if all of these proximal lesions that have kind of overlapping features maybe expand this whole spectrum, this whole continuum of what was thought to be CMPTs and now called bronchial adenomas and then glandular and mixed papillomas, and maybe all of these, since they all have somewhat similar histologic features and at least 50% have BRAF mutations, maybe start to aggregate into one continuum. The most important thing from the paper is no matter what you call them, don't call them an adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma, because they can be cured by local resections. Any comments, questions? Has anybody seen an SP in the lung?
Probably, and I called it something else.
Great. I think the pictures in this article scared me, so I thought it would be my worth presenting and also opening up this idea of maybe we should start to be lumpers versus splitters on these benign papillomas in the proximal lung.
And I love that summary. I was just pulling up that paper on the bronchial adenomas, and some of the images are—I mean, they're pretty overlapping at a minimum. And I'm afraid that if someone asked me to tell them the difference, I couldn't.
Yeah, and that was my excuse for hoping to be a lumper versus a splitter, because I couldn't tell the difference either when I looked back at that paper. But again, I think knowing the complex architecture of these papillomas, the SPs at least now, I'm hoping I won't call them an adenocarcinoma. Time will tell. This is another paper. It's a follow-up on the Coldi study. It's CRAB biopsy for identification of usual interstitial pneumonia and other interstitial lung diseases. Further lessons from the Coldi study, which was, as you know, a prospective multicenter clinical trial. The background of this is that CRAB biopsies, as we all know, are a somewhat new technology of interstitial lung disease. The reported histologic diagnostic yield for cryo biopsies is approximately 80%. And the impact of cryo biopsies on multidisciplinary discussion diagnoses, or MDDs, does compare favorably with surgical lung biopsies. There is good agreement between cryo biopsies and surgical lung biopsies. However, because of the smaller size of the tissue samples and the location of the tissue taken during a cryo, which is a more centralobular location with UIP, a predominantly peripheral process, the diagnostic confidence was frequently lower in cryo biopsies as opposed to surgical lung biopsies. So the purpose of this particular study, again, as a follow-up of the Coldice, was to define the specific histopathologic features of the cryobiopsy that predicted a diagnosis of UIP in the surgical lung biopsy, and then to define clinical indices that predict biopsy concordance between a cryobiopsy and a surgical lung biopsy for UIP. So the Coldice was a prospective multicenter study. It investigated the diagnostic agreement between a cryo and a surgical biopsy. As you remember, the participants underwent both procedures and the pathologists were blinded to the type of the biopsy procedure. The biopsies applied the international guideline criteria. And then using the results from the 65 patients from the Coldice, the cryobiopsy histopathologic, clinical, radiologic, and procedural features predicted of UIP in the paired surgical biopsy and of overall concordance was analyzed. So they took the 65 patients from the Coldice, 34 were women. UIP was diagnosed at that time in 33 of the 65, and there was an 81.5% concordance with the cryo. The most frequently reported UIP guideline criteria in the cryo were the patchy fibrosis, the fibroblast foci, the absence of an alternative diagnosis. And these three features strongly predicted histopathologic concordance with a diagnosis of UIP in the surgical lung biopsy. In this regard, the UIP guideline criteria of predominantly subpleural or paracepital fibrosis was infrequently reported. So patchy fibrosis 100% of the time, fibroblast foci 87.9% of the time, and the absence of an alternative diagnosis 90% of the time were all reported. However, that subpleural, predominantly subpleural paracepital fibrosis was infrequently reported. They also found that increased numbers of tissue samples in the cryobiopsy predicted a histologic concordance with the surgical lung. Just fibrotic HP, as one would expect, was the most frequent second choice. And then the clinical features of discordance, which I thought was an interesting part of the study, included older age, family history of ILD, and radiologic asymmetry. Finally, so I think the take-home messages of this paper are the subpleural and/or paracepital fibrosis was not essential for a diagnosis of UIP in a cryobiopsy if patchy fibrosis, fibroblast foci, and the absence of an alternative feature was present. The more tissue samples taken in a cryo, the more accurate that cryo is, or at least concordant with the surgical biopsy. Clinical features can lead to discordance. I think we all know that as pathologists, and the possibility of updating the 2018 UIP histopathologic guidelines should be revisited. I put them up on the screen just to show you this idea of the possibility of a predominant subpleural and periseptal distribution of fibrosis may not be needed in something that is a cryobiopsy. But again, I think that's the discussion that needs to be had now, is how we start to tweak these this 2018 histopathologic features and criteria. Comments, questions? Jeff was clearly an author on this study, so he can weigh in with any behind the scenes as well.
I thought that was a great summary. Thank you.
Okay, we have about 14 minutes left. Any other questions, comments? We'll move on.
Can I just take a straw poll? It sounds like the people in Rochester are seeing cryobiopsies, or others on this call seeing cryobiopsies from your institution. Are they doing them in Vermont? No. Calgary?
We're seeing them in Arizona.
You are?
Yeah.
Well, we do.
You know, I think... just a question. I mean, I think... You know, the challenge here is, you know, the study only looked at really cases of UIP, IPF, right? Is that correct, Jeff, the cold dose?
No, that's not correct. These were prospectively collected samples. So it was patients with undiagnosed ILD who went to tissue biopsy for diagnosis. So about half, I think 33 or so of the 65 had IPF, something like that.
Okay, okay. And so how often did you see, you know, giant cells and granulomas to, for example, suggest HP or aspiration on top of UIP or something like that?
I don't remember
the
frequency.
Study, I guess.
Yeah, I don't remember the frequency with which we saw that, but fibrotic HP was, I think, one of the second, it might have been the second most common diagnosis after MDD.
Yeah, okay.
Just to be clear, this is a reanalysis of the cold ice study, which is, you know, published before. So what you're really looking at here is just the data again, right? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. I thought we should present this study just because it's the biggest autopsy study of COVID. And since the lung community is so involved in this, I thought this was interesting. This is... a postmortem portrait of COVID in a large multi-institutional autopsy study. This came from archives, and you can see it was quite a large, the largest autopsy study out there now. Just to remind people of what we're in the midst of, it emerged in 2019, and since then it's been a global pandemic. The spectrum of the disease caused by COVID in humans includes pulmonary, cerebral, myocardial, hepatic, and renal pathology with clotting dysfunction. And most pathology studies report findings from a relatively small homogeneous patient population, and many are limited in their scope of evaluation of the organs and amount of tissue that they got to review. So the purpose of this large postmortem examination study was to compile the largest demographic clinical and postmortem data in those dying of or with COVID. So what it did, it comes from the United States and Sao Paulo, Brazil, which were two big areas clearly of COVID infections. Pathologists were invited to contribute by a written invitation on the COVID autopsy listserv. And then this comprehensive data from 135 postmortem evaluations of COVID patients included histologic evaluation, all the organs in most cases was provided. And that was done by the local pathologist in a 49 question survey. And you can refer to the paper for that survey. A positive diagnosis in all of these was done by PCR on antemortem 110 or in mortem, which is 12, nasopharyngeal swabs, 5, postmortem tracheal lung swabs, 1, or a combination of these. So the infection was quite well documented. Postmortem evaluations were conducted by biopsy samples of lungs, liver, heart, kidneys, spleen, brain, skin, skeletal muscles, testes in 36. And then the remainder of them was an in situ evaluation of the body cavities and the organs. This is the demographics of the cohort. This was a little bit earlier, and it was from the US and Brazil. So you can see they were younger than the people who died were younger, more male, more Black or African-American, less Hispanic, and the same proportionality of the white and Asian ethnicities. The pre-existing diseases, and none of this is surprising to us now, but were 2.88 pre-existing diseases in this cohort. The most common one was hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and then coronary artery disease. These were the causes and clinical conditions diagnosed during hospitalization. And again, acute respiratory disease in 84%. You can see kidney dysfunction, myocardial dysfunction, disseminated intravascular coagulation, and of course, concurrent infections. I mean, I just wanted to present the pulmonary pathology of this to kind of, again, this is a little bit of a lapse of where we are now, but 90 or 75% of these had acute DAD, 47 had organizing DAD. There was what they called hemorrhage in 43%. There was acute bronchopneumonia in 41%, but most attributed that neutrophilic part of the lung to a superimposed infection, probably bacterial and not part of the virus. There was something that was called tracheitis, bronchitis, bronchiolitis, and 30% mucus in the airways, emphysema, edema, and or vasculitis in 5%. We can come back to that, and then not identified or assessed in 2%. The thromboses in the lung, the macroscopic, they looked at the lungs and saw them were 16%, and microscopic were almost 40%. I thought one thing that I learned from this large postmortem was that prominent cellular inflammatory response that in the tissue or in the small vessels that people are reporting in the lungs, and also as we'll see in the heart, was not seen in this postmortem study. Cause of death was acute respiratory disease and acute myocardial infarction. So it's the largest autopsy study to date. It revealed something not, most things were not surprising. ARDS is the major cause of death. The assumptions about some diseases, such as the apparent ubiquity of widespread cellular inflammatory processes in the organs throughout the body, including the lungs and the heart, were not substantiated. And then there was a very much a discussion around, we have to make sure for the next pandemic we have, and we all agree with this, people, pathologists who are trained and willing to perform these detailed postmortem exams, because we'll learn a lot from these studies. We at the University of Michigan had people doing that, and we got to learn so much about this disease. That's all on this. Any additions, comments about your current state of I guess, COVID in the lungs or elsewhere?
You know, Carol, thanks for presenting that. I'm just wondering, did they find any infarcts in the lung? The reason I'm asking is I'm not aware. I don't think we ever found an infarct in these patients, but there's one study out there that shows like 80% of their cases had infarcts, which in the lung, which appeared to me quite high, as none of the other studies I could find ever talked about it.
They did not report. The only thing they report is that I thought what was a fairly high percentage of hemorrhage, 43%. Again, I think in the context of these particular postmortems, you know, secondary trauma from being on ventilators, all those types of things probably has to be put into the discussion here. But they did not mention an ischemic in a necrosis or an infarction, at least in the paper. But I agree, it's an interesting, you know, area that needs to be looked at.
Thank you.
Does this study show the interval between the infection, initial infection and the death? Like, what's the span?
It's a good question. No, it didn't. And I think what I think the good and the bad of this study is that it was the question, it was just a questionnaire. Nobody evaluated these slides except the local pathologists. And you can, and they did not, you know, again, the 49 questions were most, many of this was clinical. I took out the pulmonary part of it, but every organ system had a similar table in it. And you can go in and look at that data. But no, this is all I could find regarding that.
Because there seemed to be so much difference in the findings. You know, for example, we talked about we don't see all that many thrombose vessels when we looked at our autopsy cases. And I remember kind of a, you know, last May, so it's very early on, Italian study, they didn't even have super infection because they died so quickly, you know, and they assumed there is no time to develop, you know, secondary bacterial infection. And now we are seeing a longer survival after the, you know, infection. So we see kind of a so-called fibrosing DAD. It's almost like DAD didn't resolve, but a little different from fibrosing and SIP because it still has a little hint of DAD, you know? So I saw a term called the fibrosing DAD. So anyway, it was like, we are looking at basically different timeline on the, you know, behavior. So it's hard to compare, really.
Exactly. I'm hopeful that there is some multi-institutional postmortem study ongoing now that will take into account, because I agree, this has been such a fast-moving disease, clearly, that this is a snapshot at a time that may not be relevant now. Completely agree, Joanne. So I think we will see going forward many more studies that have looked at those different time periods with and without long periods of ventilation, et cetera, that have, I think, complicated this whole discussion. I'll quickly end with this last, no, I guess that's the last paper. A couple papers just of note quickly. This is an ALK rearrangement circulating tumor study, which I think is really interesting that now we're looking for these different fusions and molecular testing in circulating tumors. That was a good study, and it was the only clinical study looked at ALK in CTCs. This was a MAMA study done by the European Society of Pathology that looked at every possible permutation of PD-L1 immunohistochemistry. We had 32 different combinations of antibodies, antigen retrieval, labs versus lab kits versus LTDs, all this type of thing. And the bottom line is that you can go in and look at it for any of the antibodies you use, and you can see how each kit and or LTD was optimized. But the one take home that I read was that if you read the directions on the antibody kit, it's helpful. This is another of the ongoing micropapillary. Are there different types of micropapillary? So I won't go into it. This is a filigree pattern. You can see that it looks like, you know, micropapillary is bad, and you may, the take home, I think lesson on this one was, if you see a micropapillary pattern of any type of flavor, you might want to do immunohistochemistry on the lymph nodes to look for micrometastases. This is a paper similarly. I found this a little somewhat inscrutable. I couldn't quite define what the subtypes of micropapillary here, but they put it into basically a typical micropapillary versus a solid nest and thought that they were different types. And then again, this was an interesting study looking at pulmonary fibrosis, a history of pulmonary fibrosis in all different types of ILD. And I'll refer you to the take-home lessons on this. This is another COVID study. This was just a comparison of COVID-1 versus COVID-2. It made me look up the death tolls and the difference, which I think was just so remarkable, is that 800 people died of COVID-1, and at this point, 3.8 million have died of COVID-2, just as a comparison. A couple, two or three transplant articles that I thought were really interesting. this is a couple of articles that looked at a technique where they take a lobe of lung, which we've been looking at a long time in lung transplantation. The Japanese have been looking at it in living donors, and they present a really nice study as a bridge of using a lobe of lung to bridge people who are very sick over until they can get a complete lung for transplant. And the Toronto study where they looked at a huge number of lobe-only transplants, it did as well as complete lung. So I think this will kind of change some of the clinical approach to lung transplant. Some interesting case studies I'll refer you to, an editorial by Lynette Scholl and David Fong about the how we have to look more at cytologic preparations to use our molecular studies in tumors, especially a big demographic look at lung cancer in Austria. Three really nice review articles. And then, of course, the article we were all looking for is the cannabis. This is a French study in 1,300 patients who smoked cannabis as well as tobacco, and it just shows that it's bad for your lungs, and I'll refer you to that. And I'll stop there. Thank you all for your patience. Thank you all for your time. Good luck. Take care of yourselves.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carol. Nice job.
Bye.